ahead and call our next case, which is case number 74532, SFR Investment Pool 1 versus U.S. Bank and National Association. Mr. Galakopoulos, my Greek's not too good. Is that correct pronunciation?
That's almost spot on.
Okay, thank you. What, pure luck, I assure you. And we have Mr. Jacobs representing the respondents then. Okay, and counsel, you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Ideally, I would have 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Athanasios Agalakopoulos and Gilbert Ebron, on behalf of the appellant, SFR Investments Pool 1, LLC. I'm joined in court today by Jacqueline Gilbert, of our firm. She's the principal of our firm, and Mr. Wade is here on behalf of the Copper Ridge Community Association. Mm-hmm. Your Honors, I'd like to, assuming the familiarity with the briefing in this matter, I want to organize my argument here today around what I will refer to as the what, the how, and the why of the bankruptcy court's retroactive annulment order. But before I get into that, there are a couple of definitional matters that I wanted to square away before we get started. The first is I'm going to be making references to the automatic stay, the bankruptcy stay, the bankruptcy injunction. All of those references go back to the automatic stay, so I'm always referring to the same injunction. And the second thing is I'm going to define as the sale parties SFR, the Copper Ridge Community Association, and Nevada Association Services, even though we only represent SFR, and that inclusive of the property as well. That I'm going to refer to those entities as the sale parties. I think that'll streamline the presentation here. So first, the what. What did the bankruptcy court's retroactive annulment order actually accomplish? Well, if you look at volume 5 of the appellant's appendix at page 1141, you start with paragraph 4A. The bankruptcy court's retroactive annulment order terminates the automatic stay as to the debtor and to the debtor's estate, the two legal beneficiaries we mentioned in our briefing as being the only legal beneficiaries of the automatic stay. There they are again. Paragraph 4C. Paragraph 4C reads that the automatic stay is annulled retroactively to the petition date, the first date of the bankruptcy case. Retroactively annulled means the bankruptcy court turns the tables on the automatic stay and declares to the automatic stay that that injunction is void ab initio. Never existed. It has the plenary power statutorily conferred to do exactly that. And that's what it did. Here it is in paragraph 4C. Annulled retroactively to the bankruptcy petition date, day one. August 23rd of 2010. That date precedes the sale date by 2.5 years. There was never an injunction as to the sale parties. So it declared the bankruptcy court. And it goes on to read.
In 2017.
That's when the bankruptcy court's order was entered on May 15th of 2017.
Right.
But it has the statutory authority.
I don't think that's in dispute here. I'm going to ask your opponent. But I don't read their briefs to dispute the validity of the bankruptcy court's decision. They didn't challenge it from what the BAP did. So I'm not sure that's an issue here. I think the issue in this case is whether the district court abused its discretion in assessing the golden factors. It seems to be the central piece of the issue in the order is that the bank wouldn't reasonably anticipate that 7 years or 5 years after a sale, someone would manage to be able to retroactively set aside a stay that is on the property, especially when they had to go to a bankruptcy court and get a stay in order to pursue their own foreclosure. So I don't see any dispute here. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm going to ask your opponent here the same thing. I don't see any dispute here about the enforcement or the decision or the why or the reason for the bankruptcy court's decision. What's at issue here is whether the district court, it seems to me, properly applied Golden or not, and the standards under Golden, and whether someone would reasonably anticipate a five-year later revocation of a bankruptcy stay at the time of the sale. What say you about that?
Well, with due respect, Your Honor, I disagree with that, because the real issue here is what effect the bankruptcy court's annulment order had on the existence of an injunction.
Let's concede that it has precisely the effect you say it has.
Okay.
But the facts known at the time of the sale were different, even if the legal consequences are reversed through a nullification order. What we're talking about under Golden is the granting of equitable relief, and the equitable relief factors take into consideration the facts as known at the time of the sale. I think it would be more productive for you to address that.
But Your Honor, the bankruptcy court's annulment order does address that in the following way. What it does is it takes away the injunction, period, and there's no jurisdiction in the state courts to come in with respect to a retroactive annulment order after the bankruptcy court has declared that that injunction never existed, and then say, and then determine in fact that a violation occurred, when as a matter of law, the injunction that we're talking about never existed. And Golden does, the bankruptcy court's power to retroactively annul its own injunction cannot be made to turn on whether something was reasonably foreseeable to a party under state law.
Why not?
Because bankruptcy works, under the authorities we've cited, bankruptcy works a preemption. Any claim...
You didn't get into that until your reply brief, correct?
The subject matter jurisdiction pieces were fleshed out in the reply brief. That's correct.
I mean, it's a difficult thing to keep having the legal arguments be moving targets, frankly. So I would suggest you frame your argument to the extent possible in terms of the arguments you raised and resolved in district court and in your opening brief.
Well, with respect to that, then, we did argue in the opening brief that the annulment order is dispositive of this matter in the following sense. Once the bankruptcy court annulled the injunction, there was never a violation to speak of. So any claim that's predicated on that, and if you read the district court's order below, 32 of the 52 paragraphs in that order approximately mention a stay violation or refer to a stay violation that, as a matter of federal law, it's a legal impossibility because there was no injunction to violate. So the state court, the bankruptcy court's ability to exercise that power cannot be made to turn on whether a state court will later find that, whether it was reasonably foreseeable to a party. That's not a factor.
When the state court evaluating the equities of the circumstances, which we've said there is an opportunity to do if the requirements of the case law are established. So can't the court, in determining whether equitable relief is appropriate, take into account all the surrounding circumstances?
It cannot take into account a fact that as a matter of law cannot exist. It cannot say that an injunction existed on a given date. The injunction we're talking about, our position does not sweep broadly across all of these types of claims. With respect to this particular claim, where it's predicated expressly on the automatic stay, that's what makes this case fundamentally different. The bankruptcy court has the authority to withdraw its own injunction.
The fact that it's no longer considered a violation of the automatic stay, though, doesn't necessarily mean that this entity who went, got relief, and proceeded based on an understanding about the pending bankruptcy and all of the other surrounding circumstances, can't they still potentially seek equitable relief?
Not based on the automatic stay. If the bank has to plead the automatic
stay. So let's say it's not based on the automatic stay. It's not based on the automatic stay, but it's based on the fact that a foreclosure sale happened, which they reasonably believe to be ineffective.
But again, when the bankruptcy court has the plenary power to withdraw its injunction, the argument that they reasonably relied on an injunction or they couldn't reasonably foresee this fails in law because there's no jurisdiction over these matters, but it also fails in fact because Schwartz is the case that puts them on notice that the annulment order can issue. Schwartz discusses that. That's the very case they would cite. If you were the bank and you had to cite one case for the void ab initio doctrine, it would be Schwartz. But Schwartz also tells you that that power always remains subject to the annulment power. And both forms of relief, it's not for the state court to decide which one is better. Is a prospective termination better or is a retroactive annulment better? They both issue under the same statute. And when you understand how the bankruptcy stay normally operates, the bankruptcy court has to have this power because the bankruptcy stay issues automatically. No judicial intervention, not even an ex parte hearing, no notice, no opportunity to be heard, no opportunity for the court to shape the injunction prospectively. All judicial intervention with respect to the state comes in after the injunction exists. It's all retrospective in that sense.
I want to pause you before you. It strikes me that you're arguing as a matter of law, you've got good title and you should win because when they annulled the stay, that was the only defect in it, and so game over.
Yes.
Let's say we don't agree with that, and there's some issue about the notice of default and whether it was properly served. You say it was. One of the parties on this side of the courtroom says it wasn't. I can't find in the record that it was properly served. So there may be another deficiency in this that would give rise to a golden-type equitable relief. But this case comes up on an appeal from a summary judgment proceeding. And my question to you is, if you don't win that as a matter of law you prevail because the bankruptcy court dissolved or annulled the stay, is it your position that there are issues of fact that need to be resolved before the equitable determination can be made? And if so, what are they?
Well, thank you for the question. And
I apologize for its length.
Yes, there are definitely factual issues. Not only is it there the legal hurdle, but also there wasn't any evidence in the record that parties were affected by the automatic stay, whether bidders didn't show up. There was no evidence of that. We were there on summary judgment, and if the court was going to draw that inference, it needed to draw it in our favor. So there would definitely be issues, if you were to rule against us, that the lower court would have to consider. But our position is they had nothing else. That's why they couldn't let the stay go when they came back from the bankruptcy court. So if you rule in our favor, yes, the matter is resolved. I'd like to reserve
the... He's claiming good titles, so each of you has the burden of proof under our quiet title?
I'm sorry?
Each side is claiming good titles, so...
Yes.
Each of you has the burden of proof on summary judgment, is that?
Yeah, well, our position is that there are definitely factual issues that would need to be resolved if you don't rule in our favor on the automatic stay issue, but I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jacobs.
Good afternoon, Justices, and may it please the Court. Andrew Jacobs with Kelly Dove and Wayne Klomp of Snell and Wilmer, and Mr. Nagel for NV West has graciously ceded the balance of his time so we can argue in one piece to your honors this afternoon. This case is, in fact, completely about Golden and whether the Court applied Golden correctly. That's what this is all about. Golden, of course, has very broad, sweeping language that if there's very slight evidence of additional unfairness that works in a hydraulic way with a significantly low purchase price, if there's, quote, any unfairness, or if the owner of the property or the party interested in it, which is us, has been for any reason misled or surprised. So the Court got it right. If there's no issue of fact under Rule 56, that there was, quote, some evidence. And if the Court...
You didn't have any declaration from the bank, nothing that would show that it was not foreseeable. It was not foreseeable for the bank to have recognized that the plaintiffs or the appellants were going to go into bankruptcy court and get that set aside. The district court took no evidence here in making a ruling.
The district court was relying upon the fact that at the time of their sale, no step had been taken, no step had been announced. They cited the fact that they'd done it in some other case in 2015. They'd never done it before. There'd never been an HOA foreclosure sale that had had this set of facts occur in Nevada, to anyone's knowledge. And so the district court, in fashioning its ruling, was relying on the fact that there was no affirmative indication in the record that they would do that. I mean, it's kind of hard to sort of prove that negative and say, you know, it couldn't possibly have been foreseen, as was noted in the immediate question before this. You know, the bank
wants to expand on Justice Silver's question. Item 51 in the court's order on page 8 states, although SFR obtained a retroactive annulment of the automatic stay at the time of the HOA foreclosure sale, it was not reasonably foreseeable to U.S. Bank or indeed to any other creditor that SFR would seek and obtain an annulment of the stay several years later. There's no declaration, there's no fact, there's no statement, there's no officer testimony, there's nothing in the record that supports the judge's conclusion on that point.
And that's largely because we moved for summary judgment on January 24th when they hadn't even begun unringing the bell over here, and then the matter was presented to the court on briefing that it almost entirely occurred before they unrang the bell. But what the court is looking at, I think, most directly, Justice Hardesty, I think what the court is looking at is they're saying it generically is not foreseeable to the bank or the other creditors, because under Golden, the question is whether they deformed this sale. Did they deform this sale? It was illegal when it took place. And yes, we agree. After the fact, it became legal again 3 years later. But at the time of the sale, it was illegal for us to go participate. I mean, I've been in courts in this state, sorry? I've been in courts in this state and in the Ninth Circuit where banks are getting excoriated for undertaking actions during the automatic stay. The idea that a bank could possibly participate in such a sale is to me obviously incorrect, and everybody knows that's incorrect. The fact that they did it,
evidence that the fraud, unfairness, or oppression caused the low price at the sale.
Well, there's two parts to that, and I'll take it against my position and sort of for my position to try and answer your question, Justice Kadish. So on one hand, we didn't subjectively prove up the state of mind of whoever was at the bank when the bank was simultaneously seeking to set aside the stay so it could behave legally and foreclose its loan legally. We know in the record that happened. That's clear on the face of it. So we didn't prove up our subjective private state of thinking about this. But what we do know is that under the stay, it would have been illegal for people to go participate in a bidding. And that's the part of the argument that tends to corroborate what paragraph 51 does in this order. Because nobody, if the automatic stay is in place, should be participating in that sale. So it necessarily is at least, quote, some evidence under Golden versus Tomiyasu that the sale was conducted improperly. It must be. Because the sale is sort of perforce illegal until May of 2017. And it's great that
the law requires, and I'm not clear Golden is the only thing after the 2227 Nation Star case. It says no commercial reasonableness under Article 9, and in footnote 7 it says, well, we have Golden and we're not sure about what other kind of claims you have out here to set these aside. But I think it's pretty much a Golden type analysis. Using Golden, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances and weigh the equities in addition to finding the what you described as an hydraulic relationship. And I'm troubled about doing that on summary judgment in a case like this. I understand what you're saying, but he's saying under Schwartz, the Ninth Circuit case, which says it's void all day long when you have a sale that occurs in violation of the automatic stay versus the Fifth Circuit says it's voidable. Why shouldn't everybody try to develop what they knew when?
Because on this record, you have definitely some evidence of an irregular sale. And it's summary judgment that there was some evidence. And Golden's standard for showing is repeatedly stated as being a very low standard. And we lose. We lose in this jurisdiction all the time because there isn't really meaningful evidence of irregularity. We say, oh, no, there's a question about a notice. You know, we lose. But if holding an illegal sale isn't some evidence under Golden, then we can never win under Nevada law in Golden. We just would never win.
How did that irregularity affect the price?
Excuse me?
How did that irregularity affect the price received at the sale?
I mean, it's a but-for world. We're in the world where they ran an illegal sale, so it's hard to go back in time and find who would have been available to participate in a sale 7 years ago, and that's the problem with decaying evidence.
I mean, they didn't know about the bankruptcy. Probably other potential bidders didn't either.
Well, they should have known about the bankruptcy because they're on constructive notice, and other bidders should have been too because people buying a distressed property.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, look, I understand that, but ultimately, yeah, a sale took place. We know what they paid at the sale. But what evidence is there to make a causal connection between the violation, albeit now annulled, of the bankruptcy stay and the price brought at the sale?
Well, they kind of glibly assume that because there was a sale, that there was some sort of competition involved in the sale. If you go to AA-292, which is Christopher Harden's affidavit, their principal, he doesn't remember the sale. He says, I have a business record, I was at a sale, and at sales people attend and therefore could bid. There's literally no evidence of competitive behavior or competitive bidding. There's this extraordinarily low, to anybody else in the world, collusive-looking price, and it's at the time of an illegal sale. And at our law firm, when you're going to go buy a distressed property, you look into title, you look into liens. And, you know, I understand they were just getting...
How do we know that? Because you're representing it today? Is there an affidavit saying so?
No, because we cited cases, for example, at page 18 or 19 of our brief saying that it is customary in the industry. We had case, two federal cases saying that you do a bankruptcy scrub, so you're going to look when you're acquiring a distressed asset. So we cited authority for that proposition because it is commonplace in debtor-creditor that you're going to go look for liens, in addition to the fact that we know it from commercial practice in environments before Your Honors as well. And this court knew that.
Whether or not SFR was a BFP on this record? I mean, you don't concede that, do you?
They absolutely were not a BFP on this record, and they were doubly not a BFP. First of all, we've just been unpacking how there's a particular problem with the fact of this unresolved illegal sale issue from the bankruptcy court. But that aside, you know, and I've, again, I've lost, I'm sure, deservedly in this jurisdiction because in 1991, the statute's been out there, the bank should know. They should have known since 2006 that our lien was recorded under the deed of trust.
By the same token, the buyer at your foreclosure sale should also have known that there was already an HOA foreclosure sale, correct?
Well, if we were playing it out that way, the hypothetical reasonable buyer would also know that it was an illegal sale.
Right. So
sure.
To me, when I'm thinking about this case and the totality of circumstances, assuming you get the some element of unfairness, oppression, or fraud to get to a hearing, why shouldn't all that be hashed out in a trial rather than summary judgment with no affidavit from the bank? We just don't know who knew what when on this record.
Again, the sale was at the time illegal as a matter of law. Their principal, who was the only guy there, doesn't remember it because the testimony at 292 is that he doesn't remember it. It's that all I have is that I attend sales, and at sales I think there people show up. There's no testimony of bidding. There's no reconstructable testimony of bidding. So there never will be evidence in this record that there was competitive bidding to create this outcome, and the automatic stay deters people from coming. But again, one of your questions before to other counsel was, what about 5 years ago? How are we supposed to reconstruct when they sit on their rights for 5 years and get a valid annulment of this 5 years later? And again, you're all right. We're not contesting that. But they messed up the record in a way I can't fix because we can't go back to 2012. We don't have some wayback machine like they do under the federal bankruptcy code to excavate the factual issue implicated by what they let lie fallow for so many years on purpose. And that's inequitable.
On any other evidence of unfairness, oppression, or fraud or irregularity affecting the sale than the bankruptcy stay violation. In other words, are you joining your colleague in objecting that there was no service of the notice of default on the HOA foreclosure?
There are questions as to whether we received it that could give rise to a fact question if we lose on the principal question, but most of our appeal is founded on the propriety or not of having this bankruptcy stay out there and having a sale conducted in that environment. A reasonable bidder would not participate in that environment. And we cited cases to the effect that people do routinely when they're buying distressed properties do that. And there's some level of inference that's involved when you say what a buyer reasonably should. I mean, the law sometimes asks us to do a little bit of that. And so when you look at this, what would a buyer reasonably do when buying a distressed property? If you're buying hundreds of distressed properties, I believe they own 600, I think you look for liens. I mean, that doesn't strike me as a highly intuitive proof-dependent, highly unintuitive proof-dependent proposition.
Does it matter that the debtor, the homeowner, was the properties in Las Vegas and the bankruptcies in California, does that affect the analysis?
No, because, I'm sure along the way to their 600 properties, they've used Pacer. And anybody who's buying tens of millions of dollars of properties in value should be able to do a search for bankruptcies, and they aren't always in the same state.
Aren't we at the point, then, of speculating about facts to get a summary judgment?
I'd say no. I'd say the fact that it's an illegal sale makes it palpably irregular under Golden. I think on the face of it, the fact of an illegal sale is good enough. I don't think we should be put to the paces of excavating in 2012 who in the Las Vegas speculator community might have wanted to attend a sale on a given day. I think that's a very unfair burden flipping to
us. Wasn't your client's motion for summary judgment, or was your client's motion for summary judgment, the first time the defense or issue was raised about their sale having been in violation of the automatic stay?
That's correct, Justice.
It wasn't raised in the pleadings. It wasn't raised in a motion to dismiss. It wasn't raised at any prior time during the party's litigation.
It should have been entirely known and knowable to both parties at all times, and I completely agree, Justice. I'm not going to defend that that shouldn't have been raised earlier. It was not raised earlier. You're right.
And so once it was raised in the summary judgment motion is when they went back to the bankruptcy court to get the retroactive annulment, correct?
That is correct.
And SFR didn't conduct the sale. They're the buyer at the sale.
That's right.
Okay.
Although, as they point out, Justice, more to the point of the dialogue we were just having there, and I'm kind of falling on my sword on the pleading aspect of it, remember, they're saying, oh, look, we did this in 2015. They know how to do it. They knew they might need to do it. Their business is buying distressed properties from people who can't afford to make a couple of $100 payments on houses because they don't have enough money even to do that. And their position is that you should come in and protect them from the consequences of their palpable negligence. That's what they want you to do. When everybody knows that those people are in trouble, they know it. That's how they snap the houses up for 5 cents on the dollar. That's what they did. And it was 2015, 2 years earlier, when they got a non-proton. And in other cases we've heard from them, we know we can go get a non-proton. I mean, that's in the record. They put it in the record. So I don't think that this is a case where somebody's unfairly lying in the weeds and being mean to them because, on the other hand, they didn't know what they needed to do. They knew what they needed to do, and they failed to do it, and they got the benefit of the largesse of the property by not doing it.
So isn't that essentially an argument that they can't be a BFP?
Absolutely, and for other reasons, too, because, again, just as we're supposed to know the statute from 91, they should know our DOT being recorded from 2006. That is notice of a competing interest, and constructive knowledge is embedded in Your Honor's opinion in Shadow Wood at page 1116, which they quote over and over again, talks essentially about constructive notice. I mean, how do you not have constructive notice when you're in the business of buying distressed properties that someone who can't pay a couple $100 might be in bankruptcy, and you don't check? And if you check, you would have known. That's constructive notice. And that's a second reason, in addition to our 2006 DOT, why they can't be a BFP, Justice Pickering.
Let's say that you hypothetically have a BFP, a real one. You can't get a, can you get a Golden set aside against a true BFP?
I'm going to have to say, well, the legal effect of our argument is that the sale becomes void. But I think no. I think if a true BFP, I have to concede the answer would be no, Justice.
Yeah. And the only way to defeat a true BFP in our law would be a totally void sale. Would you agree with that? Or do you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that, but I do think this sale is void, because I do believe that under Golden, the court correctly handled the two halves of the analysis and correctly determined under 56.
Right, I was asking a different question. If you have a completely void sale, that can be set aside as against a BFP. Would you agree with that?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And under what vehicle would that occur?
I guess you would be seeking a legal declaration of the rights of the parties. It might be a quiet title action, a deck action. I'm not certain.
Okay. And in this context, they are saying, your point is, when the sale occurred, it was wholly void under Ninth Circuit precedent, the HOA sale.
Yes, but that's not really what we're arguing here so much.
Okay. Then what is the difference?
The difference between that formulation of our argument and what we're arguing is that we're not arguing the mere fact of the sale alone, which then can be unrung by the federal bankruptcy court. We're arguing that you have that fact, the illegal sale, that certainly stands independently as a ground, but what you really get is a messed up sale. It's both. It's a matter of...
So you want to do the Golden analysis. You're not really hanging your hat on void.
As I said at the start, and I was very heartened by the questions at the start of this whole session, because that's my theory of the case is implicit in those questions. We think this is a case about Golden. We think it's an inherently illegal sale because it was in violation of a stay, and you can make it so we can't sue you for violation of the stay, but you can't cure what you did 3 years before that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
Counsel, we went over a little bit with your opposing counsel our questions. We'll add 1 minute to your time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Again, Athanasios Hagelakopoulos for SFR Investments. Your Honor, I want to start first with, because some of the colloquy turned to what Schwartz, what the meaning of the Schwartz case is. This is the Ninth, this is, I'm quoting directly from the Ninth Circuit's decision from February 22nd of 2019 of this year in the Patron case, which is in our supplemental authorities. Quote, whatever the legal status of a violative act, that's Schwartz. In re Pecan Grove's holding applies by its own terms to all actions seeking to enforce the protections of the automatic stay. That means you have to have the right party in the right court, and they actually have to move to enforce the matter. That's a direct quote from the Ninth Circuit's decision in Patron. Just as an aside, in connection with our arguments regarding the impermissible collateral attack on the bankruptcy court's order here, the Patron case is actually on this court's docket. After the Ninth Circuit's mandate issued on March 18th of 2019, but that case is here for appellate review on automatic stay issues at case number 76066, U.S. Bank versus SFR Investments Pool 1. Subject matter jurisdiction is always at issue. It's always at issue. That's why it can be raised on appeal. There wasn't subject matter jurisdiction to essentially countermand the annulment order by declaring that an injunction existed on a date when it did not. The court's questions to the bank's counsel are spot on regarding the lack of the causal link. There has to be a causal link between what is the alleged act of unfairness and bringing about or causing what the bank complains to be the grossly inadequate sales price. Those questions were spot on. There's no evidence in the record to support that. Also,
do you agree that the notice of default was not served on the bank?
The notice of default was not served on the bank?
The HOA's notice of default was not served on the bank.
I don't have.
Your brief says, and it cites the notice of sale, that it was served on them. The answering brief from your colleague on the other side says, no, it was not.
That would be a question for the lower court then to decide if the bank
because
can't
establish. It appears to be that he's correct and you're not, that the notice of default was not served on the bank.
That would be an issue then as a factual matter for the trial court because of where we were at on summary judgment. That would have to be something that the trial court would have to determine.
Was Wells Fargo the servicer for U.S. Bank at the time?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Were they served with the notice of default?
I'm not aware. I don't know the answer to whether they were served or not. But again, that would be an issue that, again, because of the procedural posture and the lack of evidence as was admitted to it regarding the causal link, that again would have to be something that the lower court would have to flesh out on a remand. But that's not enough to sustain their position here. So,
did the court make any finding about whether the notice of default and notice of sale were properly served?
I don't believe that's the gravamen of the court's order is almost entirely predicated on the automatic stay and its observations regarding how that impacts the fairness issues under Golden.
And this is not your issue on appeal.
With respect, with due respect, when the automatic stay was brought into this.
Let me rephrase.
I'm sorry.
The absence of service, that's not your issue on appeal, nor is it their issue in the answering brief.
Right. If you're going to base it on that, you have to.
We don't even have that argued.
Right.
In this
I know
case.
That. So you have to send okay. It back. So at the end of the day, then there are also issues regarding. They had the opportunity to contest these issues in the bankruptcy court, and they didn't do that. Or they opposed the retroactive annulment. They didn't appeal it. It's a final order, and it should be given effect here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Can I ask a question, too?
Sure.
Sir, do you agree that the annulment was one of the factors the district court could consider in weighing equities? Or do you think they're not allowed to consider it?
No, because MSR, the case we cite in our supplemental authorities in Grunts, envisioned a unified court system. If the injunction that we're talking about issues automatically, the bankruptcy court has to have the power to reach out and pull back its injunction and to declare to the world that it never existed.
So your position is in doing an equitable weighing under Golden, the
yes.
court may not consider the fact of the annulment. Is
yes,
that your
and there, yes, and there is authority to that effect. This is the Eastern Equipment case in our supplemental authorities. And to show you how powerful these interests are, the federal interest here. Even federal district courts, and this is a quote, district courts simply lack jurisdiction. The federal district courts lack jurisdiction to hear claims asserting violations of the automatic stay that sound in state law. The moment you plead the stay as part of a state law claim, preemption principles kick in, converts it to a federal claim, and that had to be brought in the bankruptcy court. I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
Well, thank you, counsel, very much. Thank both counsel for your excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate it very much, bringing this interesting issue to us today. So we will take this under submission, and we'll be in recess till 2:30 p.m.